Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Podcast, presented by SportsShoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Every Sunday we get together with a guest from the distance running world,
giving you an insight into the lives and training of some of the UK's best athletes and coaches.
You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all major podcast streaming services.
You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Sunday Podcast, where we post about our past and present guests, host giveaways, and much more.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome back, guys. Great guest for you as always, but an absolute honour to welcome Chris O'Hare to the podcast. I'm sure I speak for both myself and Matt when I say that Chris was a fantastic athlete to watch when I was growing up and getting into the sport. Chris needs no introduction, but he's got a PB of 3:32 in the 1500 and ran 25 sub-4 miles throughout his career.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for tuning in once again. I've been told my intros are probably a little bit too long, so, I mean, for this one, Chris O'Hare, he doesn't really need much introduction, does he? Kind of, if you like, started the 1500 meter revolution in the UK, definitely Scotland. Kind of paved the way, showed the other guys what they can do. And, you know, when we ask Chris, what is, you know, your best achievement in track and field? You know, it's not the 3:32 from Monaco or the 25 times sub 4 minute miles. It's the fact that, you know, he was able to inspire and connect with so many people in the sport. And I think that's very telling of, you know, his personality. And the kind of athlete he was. So, look, it's a brilliant episode. And I do feel like because he's retired, we get a little bit more out of him as well. You know, we talk about contracts a little bit. You know, his life under Adidas. He was an Adidas athlete his whole career. You know, races, injuries, coaching styles. So, all good stuff. Enjoy, as always. Take care and get out for your Sunday run. Summer's almost upon us.
First of all, Chris, just welcome to the podcast and happy retirement from us. How's your life been different in the past, few weeks, I guess? Or has it been a month yet?
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been longer than that. I had kind of made the decision to retire, you know, somewhat significantly before I actually made it, you know, public with, you know, still contracted through the end of last year. So it's, you know, when are you actually allowed to say you're retiring, etc. I wasn't going to be bothered reading through the contract to figure that out, so I just waited. I would say it's been at least 4 or 5 months, you know, and then probably another 4 or 5 months before that of kind of going back and forward, kind of knowing that was going to be the case, but not fully committing to it. But since fully committing to it, it's been, you know, honestly been a bit of a weight lifted off my shoulders, because it was quite stressful kind of going back and forward. But ultimately it came down to, you know, look, I'm willing to put myself in the, you know, it's going to take, if I want to get back to that level, it's going to take everything I've got. And I was willing and prepared to do that to kind of put myself at the bottom of that well, but wasn't really prepared to do it to my wife and to my children. So it kind of made that decision a little bit easier, because, you know, whilst they would have supported me, and, well, my kids don't know, but no, my wife would have supported me in that, it's still, you know, I didn't want her to have to make that decision and have to live with that for the, you know, even if I'd said I'll give it one more year, it would have been a pretty shitty year for everybody involved. And so like it turned out to be not quite as difficult a decision as I thought it might be.
Yeah, it sounds like it was something that was going to be my next question is, you know, had you dwelled on the thought of retiring for a while? Because I think most athletes do, you know, it's not an impulsive decision. It's something which builds up over time, I take it. But I want to touch upon, you know, you said it would have been quite a shitty year had you, you know, carried on and gone for, you know, maybe the Worlds. Yeah, it's the Worlds this year, you know, European stuff like that. In what sense would it have been hard?
Well, I mean, just so I think if you kind of take my previous years of time commitment, for instance, you know, if I kind of run through a hypothetical what this year would have looked like, it would have been probably going on an altitude camp before in January, probably spend the whole month of January away at a camp, go and race a few races indoors, be back for British champs, and then probably have to stay in Europe until going to World Indoors. So that's pretty much like even just in the first 3 months of the year, I probably would have been home for what, 2 or 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I've got a 5.5-year-old, a 2.5-year-old, and a 6-month-old. And so, you know, being away from them at work all day is a bit shit. So being away from them for that long, it would be really shit. So, you know, I'm sure if I was able to commit time and effort into getting back, I would have been able to get back, but there's no guarantee of that. You know, I could have committed all that time and effort and energy and still not made any of the teams. It's not like British middle distance running is a cakewalk. So, you know, it could very well have been all of that time and effort, not just from me, but from everybody else involved, to actually not achieve anything. Mm-hmm. But you know, when I mention it would have been a bit shitty. I'm really referring to the amount of time that I would spend away from home.
Mm-hmm. With the last race you did, I'm right in saying that was in 2020. Did you know that would be the last one, or was there any inkling at all?
No, not at all. You know, I was getting ready for Tokyo. That was the game plan. And so, yeah, not even close. And would I have done things? I would ask myself this. I mean, would I have done things differently if I'd known? Would it be different if I'd known that it was going to be my last race? Probably not. I was getting ready for the outdoor season, and then my hip had honestly been bothering me since probably summer 2017.
Wow.
So it's been years that it had been on and off bothering me, giving me kind of lower back issues, lower abdomen issues, and ultimately all, you know, in hindsight, it was all because of this torn labrum in my hip. And it wasn't until that summer that I was like, this is really sore. You know, kind of, well, probably the spring, April time was when I was doing sessions by myself, kind of everybody was in lockdown. I was just at the track by myself and doing sessions, and I'm like, can't really tie my shoelaces properly. I'll have to like modify the way I bend down to tie my shoes. So then going ripping speed sessions, and you're like, I could run mechanically, I could run, and it wasn't that sore when I ran, but then any other movement, any other time of the day, it was just killing me. So once it was official that Olympics were moved to next year, there was like, there's no way that this hip lasts through a whole nother year. So that was that. That was like, okay, well, you know, we tried to rehab it without surgery based on the size of the tear, but honestly, I think the tear was just getting a bit bigger. And so it was November time that we got the surgery. And kind of that was that. I mean, it was at that point post-surgery that we were like, okay, what do we do here? Give it 4 or 5 months, see if I can get back to running. And it was just really difficult, really, you know, kind of 2 steps forward and 1.5 steps back every week, it seemed like. So wasn't making a whole lot of progress, and then the rest of the decision-making process comes into it as well. But yeah, it's crazy to think that it's been, at this point, 2 years since I last like laced up a pair of spikes and stepped on the start line.
I was going to say, there's a part of you, did you want a big sort of send-off like we've seen Adam Cachot announce his retirement and stuff? Did you want to sort of bow out the sport in a similar way, or you're kind of okay with how you left it?
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of in my personality wouldn't, like, if I was able to race, I would be racing. So my retirement was really based around the fact that I couldn't race. So, or I wouldn't be able to commit the time and effort to get back into racing at that level. If I was physically able to race, I would be racing. So I don't ever, probably never ever foresaw myself standing on the start line for a race, being like, this is my last race, like, being great, because, you know, I it's just not kind of my personality, I guess, and that point in my career. But the romantic notion of kind of getting to go out at like the London Diamond League or something like that and being your last race and, you know, getting to say bye to everybody would be great. But the harsh reality of the sport is that most people don't get that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, Chris, you had a fantastic career, and I think athletes are notorious for, whilst they're running, to always want a little bit more. Are you able now to look back and be kind of content and happy with how your career was?
Yeah, a little bit more than I was. You know, it's, as you mentioned, athletes are always, you know, athletes are required, in effect, you know, if they've made it this level in the first place, they have to have that capability of only really focusing on their failures, because, you know, you don't learn anything when you win, right? And so every time you get pumped, it's like, right, okay, back to work, back to the drawing board, get it fixed and get going. So I mean the things that stick out to me through my career are my failures, and they're getting that is slowly going to the other side and able to see the successes a bit more and ignore the failures a bit more. But that just comes with time, I think, and acknowledging that you're no longer racing anymore, so you can't fix those failures. So what have you got left? You've only got the successes, so try your best to kind of acknowledge them for what they are and take the benefit out of those successes.
Which you have plenty of, to be fair. I always think it's interesting speaking to an athlete who's retired and you ask them, you know, what are you most proud of? Because sometimes it's not the PB they ran, it's not the, you know, the British champs they won. What are you most proud of, to, you know, throughout your career?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's for me, the people that I've been able to influence, the people that I've been able to, and maybe influence is the wrong word, but being able to touch throughout my career, from other athletes that have become great friends to kind of helping mentor kids at the University of Tulsa, helping mentor kids at Edinburgh Athletics Club, like even just the, you know, the kid that you saw one time at a Diamond League and you gave them their number, that kind of thing. All those memories for other people that they will never forget is quite special. And sometimes it's difficult to actually touch on them because you don't know exactly what those memories are for people.
Yeah.
But knowing that, I was incredibly fortunate to have so many home championships throughout my career, from Glasgow in 2014 all the way through to kind of Glasgow indoors in 2019, with London and everything, like with London's World Champs in the middle and Diamond Leagues and everything like that. I've been very fortunate to have been able to race in the UK quite a lot at a major level, and so there's got to be hundreds, if not thousands, of instances where somebody will somebody has an interaction, whether it be personal or just standing in the crowd, with my performances and me as a person, and that will kind of live longer for me than like records or, well, records that have all been broken since anyway, but and medals and stuff like that. You know, those are incredibly proud moments.
No, and I think the way you raced and always kind of like put on a show and was always very determined racer, very gritty. I think you probably inspired quite a few as well. So I think a lot of people listening will be able to relate to that. But then also you talk about mentoring a little bit. You know, you kind of led the way in Scottish middle distance running. That's kind of what you'll be known as. I mean, before, am I right in saying before the 2013 World Champs, I think a British man hadn't made the final in 6 years. And you kind of broke that mold. And then went on to, you know, do your things. And really, you know, we've now seen Gourley and Whiteman and loads of Scots coming through. And Kerr, are you proud of that?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And you know, it's nice when I did retire, and it was nice to see those messages and from Josh and Jake and Neil and all the other guys that I've raced against throughout the years that were like, look, you know, seeing you do it was able, gave us the confidence and the belief that we could do it. Mm. And I think what's funny is you mentioned that being gritty, that kind of thing. I always kind of had to race above my ability level and just squeeze every single last drop of juice out of that orange, if you will, on the day. And ultimately, for me to make finals at a World Championships, it was like a trek to get there. and so, but it was, you know, for my ability level, if you will. So for them to then see that and say, okay, well, you know, we know now that it's possible. We know now what to do. And especially with Josh, I trained with Josh for years when he was young. Whenever I was back at summers and Christmas and stuff like that, we were trained together. So, you know, he was able to get that kind of firsthand of this is what it's going to take. Mm-hmm. And getting that at a young age is super helpful, but absolutely not to take away from anything that the incredibly talented guys that have a work ethic that's, you know, pretty rare these days. So,
has it?
It's
No, I was just going to say, has it surprised you how quick they've ended up running? You know, 3:28 and 3:29 for Kerr and Whiteman. Has that surprised you a little bit?
No, not really. Not really at all. I think I actually hate to mention it, but I think the shoe technology has changed the game for sure. Not to take away from what they're doing, because like, where would even in the old shoe tech, like for instance, had I really focused on trying to run fast, or had maybe a few more years in sport, in the old school spikes, breaking 3:30 was the goal. Mm. So if that was my goal, then it should absolutely be Jake and Josh's goal. Mm. And more athletes. So it doesn't necessarily surprise me that they're running that fast, because they would have been there even in the old shoe technology. They would have been right there, pretty close to it anyway. But I think the shoe tech has definitely changed the game, and being in the sense of being able to run like low 3:30s and or mid 3:30s in a heat, then low 3:30s in a semi-final, and then sub 3:30 in a final, all within the space of 5 days, 4 days, or whatever it is. Like, I think that's where the shoe tech has really kind of changed the game. I'm just disappointed that I didn't ever really get to actually take advantage of the shoes, because they seem to, from what I know, it would have lended itself to my training style of just knocking my pan in all the time, and being able to kind of get that, you know, have the shoes take care of my legs and my body a bit better than the old shoes would have certainly helped, I'm sure.
Mm. Well, let's talk about your training a bit if we can, because obviously you mentioned then that you kind of train quite hard, and I think that's the impression a lot of people get as well. Is what's kind of the key thing that you'd say, like, across your career that did make you so good?
Yeah, I think you know, that's a tough one. It's, I think it could just kind of be general, just my work ethic was, you know, it was always, all right, I'm here to get better today. Let's get a lot better. You know, I was kind of lived by the mentality that probably got me hurt quite a lot, but it was like, if I could get a little bit better today, then I can also get a lot better today. So let's get a lot better. Well, I get a little bit better, but you can get a lot better. So that's just kind of the mentality of, that I was raised with, kind of how my parents had to do things and how what they instilled in us. So yeah, just super, super kind of blue collar, if you will, like not particularly fancy, not, you know, I've probably taken lactate numbers like 3 times in my whole career. And it was on British camps where you finish a rep and somebody's sticking your ear with a pinprick and you're like, what are you doing? Like what you're telling me about my lactate numbers, I'm not going to not smash these next 3 reps because my lactate's too high. Like take that data and stick it somewhere because I'm not really that concerned. Like, so I was just kind of, you know, there's obviously a lot of value in those and kind of being super scientific with it. But I was kind of a bit more old school in the sense of, you know, keep technology out of it too much, or not get too enthralled in all the tech and not get through too enthralled in all of this and that. Just get hard work in. And if you knock your pan in, then you'll get better.
I'm sure a lot of people listening will love hearing that, to be honest. One thing we wanted to chat about was Tulsa and your time there, because obviously we've seen since yourself, like other great athletes come out of there, like Brits, obviously like Mark Scott and Paddy Deaver doing really great things over the 5K right now. Do you mind just talking to us about your time there and how you actually went there in the first place and what it was like?
Yeah, it's not too dissimilar. My journey, my Tulsa journey is not too dissimilar to just kind of my Scottish athletics journey, really. Because, you know, in the same way that there were Scottish athletes that I looked up to that had achieved a certain level, there were British athletes at Tulsa, John Beattie, Lewis Timmins, who had achieved a level, you know, making British teams, British junior teams, under 23 teams, that kind of thing. So I had those guys to look up to, and then my goal was always to surpass. And so that is what I did at Tulsa. That's what I did within Scottish athletics, was kind of use those guys as a kind of springboard to make it to the top level, if you will, quote unquote top level. But and then same thing at Tulsa. I used those British guys, Lewis and John, as a springboard, and then Mark and Paddy and other athletes since have kind of used my success and what I've done as a springboard for their success, which is, I'm all for it. That's what it's there for, right? That's what I'm there for. So yeah, Tulsa was not a huge name before I went. But it was the right fit for me. And honestly, I would have, if I could do it a million times again, I'd choose Tulsa a million times. Because it allowed me to grow as an athlete in that kind of blue collar way, and the way that suited me. Like had I gone to Oregon, for instance, but we all know Oregon, we all know how good it is of an environment it is. We all know the athletes that it can produce, like, you know, take Westy for an example. Like it's helped him progress into a world-class athlete. It probably wouldn't have done that for me because it's a bit too, you know, fancy, if you will. It's very controlled. You know, it's their way and they do it. And so Tulsa kind of gave me the freedom to work with the coaching staff, work with the training staff, the athletic training staff, work with my teammates, and just kind of create a tide that rises all ships. Or lift all ships. I'm not really sure what the phrase is, but we'll roll with it anyway. And so yeah, Tulsa was perfect for me. I love Tulsa as a city. Obviously, we've stayed here, and so it's a great place and a great place to live and train. And the University of Tulsa is a great university. I think, you know, there's so many athletes, British athletes, that go to the US, don't succeed, and blame it on the US system. I've said this before, I'll say again somewhat unapologetically, those athletes were very unlikely, if not for sure, not going to succeed in the UK either. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's also an environment. You have to create your own environment. You have to do your homework on the environment before you go. And I think too many kids get sucked in by the name of the big university. They go and they're like, this isn't what I want. This isn't what I expected. And they fail. They effectively fail. So, you know, I think that's what Tulsa is good at, is taking athletes, British and American athletes, who are not at the top when they come, and turning them into athletes who can be at the top when they leave. Mm. Myself, Mark, and Paddy are perfect examples of that. And it's a team environment, it's a coaching philosophy, and a chemistry thing.
Yeah, I'm interested how they do that, because, you know, one thing which shocks me about yourself a little bit is you're probably, you know, the best miler to come out of Tulsa, and it's more renowned for like the 5 and the 10K guys, like you were speaking about BT before, and obviously Scott and Paddy since. How did you kind of, you know, get that perfect mix? Because you had some really good cross results as well, and you must have been good at the longer stuff, but to come out of there and be an NCAA mile champ, which seems quite rare from what I know about the Tulsa program and stuff, it seems quite distance focused.
Yeah, it's a strength-based program. Honestly, when I went to Tulsa, I went out to be a 5K, 10K guy. Right. You know, my junior, you know, I had my preferred event when I went to Tulsa was the 5K. And like you said, I've had some good results in cross. And so it wasn't my whole freshman year. I was like, okay, I'm going to be a 5K guy. I'm still a 5K guy. It wasn't until we ran the mile indoors my sophomore year as preparation for the 5K outdoors.
Yeah.
And I ran 3:56 and got second in nationals by like 0.2 seconds. We were like, all right, shit, maybe I'm a miler. Mm. And so, yeah, it was kind of at that point that we just kind of ran with it. And I wish I'd done more 5Ks, but it's a tough schedule in the US, especially when you're trying to also run a British season as well, or European season as well. So yeah, it just kind of happened by accident, really.
And then at that point you had the mile success. Did you then change the training more to mile? Were you just like, right, well, let's just keep training like we're training, because that's working in the mile? Because it would have been tempting, I guess, to, you know, be like, right, imagine if I was quicker now, you know, and
right,
some of the stuff you were doing. So I'll be interested. Yeah. Which one did you choose?
Pretty much stuck to what we were doing. Because all cross season, I trained as a 10K guy for the 10K cross. And then when you get into indoors, yeah, I mean, probably two or three times a month, there would be sessions that I would do that were different. But part of that is because it was, okay, we're focusing on the mile, but part of it was also, you know, you're a 3:56 miler, and then progressing from that. And the next, you know, we're at the time, we didn't have sub 14 minute 5K guys. So who are you doing those sessions with? So I would have been doing it by myself anyway. So it was kind of make it a bit more specific, take a few of the 8 guys and kind of use and abuse them as we need to for the 15 sessions. So yeah, it stayed pretty much the same, and the like I say, the training philosophy is strength based, and I think that scares British people because we're kind of a speed and specific sessions from a very young age, and so it's almost like okay, forget everything you know, let's build the strength first. Like if you want to run a 3:50 to 3:55 mile, you have to be able to run a good strong 5K. There's no way about it, right? So even if you're an 8:15 guy, You still need to be able to do a good 5K. And so that's just, I've never been an 8 guy. I've never had the raw speed for an 8 to be an 800 runner. I actually probably couldn't even tell you what my 800 PB is, but it's not as good as it needed to be, but I just wasn't an 8 guy. So, you know, it's just, if you're not an 8 guy, you have to be a 15.5 guy. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was. And I prefer the strength stuff.
Yeah. So how much of that strength work from Tulsa then did you take into the rest of your professional career then?
Quite a lot. It got more specific. Terrence is a very intelligent and very kind of specific coach. And so it got more specific, but still trying to capitalize on that strength stuff. But a bit more specific with a bit more kind of strength speed work, and got more technical in the gym and stuff like that to tighten up form and whatnot, but it didn't necessarily change too much.
Mm. Yeah. Lum jumped the gun a little bit there. You graduated Tulsa and you signed with Adidas, correct? And you're with Adidas, you're one of the rare pros, I guess, who kind of were at Adidas your whole career, spanning what? It must've been about 8 years or so, 9 years even.
8 years, yeah. 8 years of contract and really probably seven years of racing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I was loyal to Tulsa, was loyal to Adidas, and the great brand kind of stuck by me, and they were always, you know, always at the forefront of the technology advancement. I have no complaints with repping one company my whole career. It you know, they made it easy to do so, but I was keen to stay loyal to a brand who chose to support me.
Yeah. And then we kind of want to know, and I'm sure the listeners do as well, about, you know, when you were first at college, you would have signed a contract and sort of, you know, how long were the contracts? Did they vary over time? Or was it just like 2-4 year deals? You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So I signed, it was 2 4-year deals. It was, you know, first time around we had, you know, a bunch of offers on the table. None of them were really all that appealing, and then Adidas, you know, Adidas came in with the best offer by far, and it was, you know, not just from a financial point of view, but from everything else that goes along into those contracts was kind of what we were looking for. The second contract was like, hey, you've been running well, here's the increase, and we're like, great, sign it. We're not looking to take that contract and leverage it to try and get other deals and all this stuff. It was, look, they realized that I've progressed. Let's stick with it. Go with it. So yeah, it wasn't ever too stressful, really, which is nice.
Yeah, because I guess it sounds like you were quite fortunate. I mean, you make your own luck, to be fair, but quite fortunate in that sense, because, you know, 2 year deals, and I wonder what it was like at the end of the 4 years. Obviously you had progressed, but did you feel any extra pressure when you were kind of in that, you know, contract liaison period?
I don't remember. So it can't, if I don't remember, it can't have been that stressful. I'm sure there was, but I don't really remember. So it can't have been too bad. Mm. Not traumatized by it.
Yeah, you talked about being loyal to the company themselves, and I guess that pays in that they were loyal to you too with offering you a contract and an increase. Do you think that's almost something we don't see enough of in the sport?
That's a hard one. That's a hard one to answer, just kind of because every situation is so different. Mm. Every athlete's different. They're represented by different agents who have different relationships with different shoe companies, and not even that, even more so than that, just different relationships with different people within the company, within the shoe company, so, which can be problematic. So, yeah, I mean, had at the end of 4 years that Adidas said, that's great, but you know, you've ran really well, going to keep you on the same, and New Balance comes along and says, you've done great, we want to offer you $30,000 more. Mm-hmm. Sorry, like that loyalty only goes so far. You know, it's loyalty kind of goes both ways. It has to be reciprocal, and so that was not something I had to really deal with. But I certainly don't ever criticize or look down on anyone for changing up shoe companies every 2 years. If that's what's right for them and their family and their situation, then that's what needs to be done. Running is not a long career. It's not fortuitous enough financially to make this. We're not talking millions of dollars every year. You know, you need to be smart with it. And I'd say for the most part, athletes and representation do a decent enough job with being smart.
Mm. Yeah, to be fair, I was meaning more the other way. Like, do the companies almost, I don't know, if you've chosen to sign with them in the first place, maybe you see some companies not giving people the raise they should get, enabling them to be loyal.
Right, right. And I'll speak freely on this. Nike are the worst.
Mm.
Well, the worst for lots of reasons, but the worst in that regard being that they, without fail, leverage the athlete's coaching relationship against the athlete. They're negotiating against the athlete and using their coaching relationships, etc., to pay the athlete less, which I think is wrong. I think it's the wrong way of doing it. It's obviously a business. Maybe it's not even the right business decision. That's the right decision for the bottom line on the page that year of the Excel spreadsheet. I don't think it leads to increasing performances or increasing relationships with coaching and staff, coaching and athletes. I think we often see athletes literally being forced to move on from a coach that they're running really well with, a situation that they're very happy with, a team that they have great chemistry with. They're pretty much forced to move on because Nike are leveraging that relationship against the athlete, and the athlete has to go run for a different company, even if that isn't what they would choose to do, because you know they can only take less from Nike to a certain degree.
Mm. Yeah, kind of sabotaging the sport a little bit and athletes' performances in that sense. Did you deal with American contracts, Chris, you know, American Adidas, if you like, you weren't under the European umbrella? And would you encourage more athletes who do well in the NCAA to kind of seek out an American deal?
So I was my contract was through Adidas Global, so everything actually went through Germany, because that's where their global headquarters is. So that's, you know, there's an Adi UK, an Adi US, and Adi Global. And so I was with Global, which was great because I was, you know, going back and forth between the two countries, and I never had to deal with anything logistically of who am I talking to, where am I getting stuff from, what's happening here. It was just like, you know, I've got my point of contact, and that's that. Mm-hmm. Don't worry too much about it. I'm not sure how qualified I am to speak on what other athletes should do. I think, you know, the only real thing you can do is create a relationship with a good agent, or create a good relationship with an agent, and let them do their job. Mm. Be open to living anywhere, or be very transparent with where you want to be and who and you know what you want to do, what group you want to be with, or a selection of groups you want to be with. Obviously, if you say, look, I'm only going to go join On Group in Colorado, or I'm only going to go join Bowerman, like, then you take all leverage away out of your situation. And the shoe companies know that. It's the business deal. They have to make the best business decision. And we've seen that in the past. and athletes will probably take less for it. However, if that's the best, if you go and say, look, Coach Ritz is who I want to be with. I want to be on the on team, and I don't care relatively how much they pay me. If it's within this bracket, I'll take it because they're going to progress my career, and I'll earn it on the back end.
Mm.
It's, you know, we can probably get a little caught up in how much you get paid day one versus how much you might earn in bonuses and rollover bonuses and future contracts if you're in a situation and in a group that you are very confident is going to be the best situation for you.
Motivate yourself more, you know. Did you ever kind of change from a performance driven to financially driven?
I think, you know, yeah, so I, you know, my, when I came out, I was kind of looking at Bowerman, Mark Coogan's group in Boston, and I'd worked with Terrence in Terrence's British Athletics endurance coach in 2013. And so I'd worked with him when I was in Moscow and holding camp before Moscow and then in Moscow. And I was like, this guy is amazing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I wanted to try and make that work. And then, like I mentioned, that, you know, the Adidas contract was the best one. And so it worked out because Terrence was, you know, really my number one decision on coaching. I was fortunate enough that I didn't have to make that one or the other decision, which was lucky on my part. It kind of is what it is. You see athletes have to make that decision, and it's probably not that easy of a decision. But for me, it was pretty easy.
Yeah, it's great. It sounds like you obviously got the best of both, like you've highlighted. I just want to chat about, I guess, how that training sort of looked. Obviously, you had a lengthy career, so I guess it's hard to pick maybe what the training was across all of it. But maybe when you're running like your personal best 3:32, what sort of training would you do in the summer? Like, do you mind talking us through what a typical week might look like?
Yeah, it's kind of hard for me to remember, honestly, because I haven't done it for a while. But also, like, I was never that. I never spent a huge amount of time analyzing the training and stuff like that. Kind of left up to Terrence that, you know, wasn't one that would kind of sit with his training diary for hours on end and analyze the session versus when I did it 6 weeks ago. And what does that mean? I just didn't have the energy for it. Couldn't be arsed. And so, you know, a lot of, you know, kind of bread and butter stuff would be 4 or 5 by a K, get some strength work in. And then like a little bit more kind of speed endurance stuff, and then just kind of some speed stuff with a lot of, you know, Terrence is big on technical stuff. So we would do, you know, on our non-session days, we would do a lot of kind of ancillary stuff in the gym and at the track with drills and all of that and kind of short sprints for form and stuff like that. So it was definitely more kind of technical than I was used to, but never got too crazy with it.
With that then, you mentioned you can't like think of exactly, are there any specific workouts that do stick out from your career?
I don't even remember what the session was, but when I did run my PB, I think Monaco was probably on the Friday. I think it was on the Friday night, like a Friday night, and I had done a session on the Wednesday that was just like probably one of the hardest sessions that I had done up at altitude in St. Moritz, because I didn't think, we hadn't got in, we were on the wait list and we hadn't got in, and we were like, forget it, let's just smash a hard session Wednesday and be done with it. Like, I'm like lying on the floor, throwing up all over the place after the session on Wednesday. And then like not but an hour after I get back to the flat after my session, my agent Ray calls me, he's like, you got into Monaco. I'm like, fuck. You're not gonna turn it down. So I'm like, all right, I'll get a flight booked, pretty much sat my ass in an ice bath for the next like 36 hours to try and recover. But I don't even, honestly, I can't even remember what it was. It was probably something like three sets of four fours or something like that. Just cranking them down. It was a tough one, but you know, you those instances you learn, like, all right, like, we put a lot of pressure on recovering from sessions, when in all actuality your body recovers a lot quicker than you think it does.
Isn't it weird how, like, you know, the ultimate performances work out, but like with everyone's, you know, best run, there's always this little story behind it, and it's never, you know, the preparation's never perfect, and it sounds like you kind of learned that then.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you ask someone, well, what's perfect preparation, you'll get a million different answers. And in all actuality, your body deals very well with stress. It deals very well with, like, with physical and emotional stress if you know how to handle it, and you know how to deal with it and take care of your body. And so that kind of 48 hours before Monaco that year, I probably took better care of my body than ever before, because I had to, otherwise I was going to get smoked. So it, you know, maybe a hard session on 48 hours from a Monaco Diamond League is the way to do it. I don't know. Probably not. But like, it does force you into focusing on the recovery.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because like you said, you were forced into it. You know, usually if you'd sessioned on a Monday or a Tuesday, maybe you just sort of, you just tick over them next few days and not quite recover as well. But look, you're a father of three now. So, and obviously you were a father when you were still competing. Now, we just want to talk how that kind of changed the way you raced, maybe the way you trained, and just changed your life in general. Because obviously it's a huge change, and it didn't affect you.
Oh, it definitely did affect me.
Not from what, as fans, not from what we saw, but yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, from my wife had, like, I want to say 6 or 8 weeks maternity leave at the place she worked when Ronan was born, my first. We still lived in Boston at the time, so we didn't have any family help. And so Monday, when she went back to work, like Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, I would run on the treadmill in my living room. So all of my mileage Monday to Friday, apart from track sessions, were on the treadmill in my living room with Ronan just like sitting in his bouncy chair. And then Saturday and Sunday, she was obviously not at work, so I could go to run with the group. But so other than track sessions, everything was done on the treadmill. And then even some of the sessions weren't track sessions, they were tempos, so those were done on the treadmill as well. And then when we were at the track, for 3 or 4 weeks, the group went to altitude camp in Mammoth, and so it was just me and Ronan. And one day, I've told this story a bunch, of apologies if people have heard it before, but one day it was just me and Ronan at the track, and he would always fall asleep in the car. We'd get there, he would normally stay asleep for me to warm up around the indoor track, do my session, and then I would feed him his bottle before I'd go to the weight room, and then he would normally just be awake and watch me in the weight room till I was done. At this day, I'm like 200, 300 meters into like 4 by a mile on the indoor track, and he just starts screaming. I'm like, oh, fuck. I'm like, all right, I'm just going to have to call it and like, just call it a day, come back another day. But the janitor at the Harvard indoor track came and was this lovely Jamaican, elderly Jamaican guy, was like, can I hold him? And I was like, absolutely, mate, like, go ahead. So he held him for a bit and then put him in his pram and just kind of pushed him around in the round indoor track while I'm knocking out mile reps. I'm kind of like one eye on the watch, one eye on the janitor I've never met before. But immediately there was times where even Lindsay Sharp's mum was in town and Carol just held running the whole time. When the group was there, Terrence would like have four or five stopwatches around his neck and running in one arm, trying to take everybody's splits and stuff like that. So you just kind of adapt and survive. But from a mental point of view, it definitely changes who you're doing it for and why you're doing it. You know, when you're in a race and you're like, not feeling it today, I just really feel like shit. You know, you definitely get a bit more of like, okay, well, like, at this point, you need to beat the kid and put nappies on his arse, so you better get back up there in the top three and get your arse in here. But yeah, I would say it definitely only positively affected my career, negatively affected my sleep, but you know, you overcome those things.
Is he are we going to see Ronan on the track anytime soon?
I'm sure we will. I would prefer to get into something that pays a bit better at a professional level, because I'm assuming they're all going to be professional athletes. That's going to be the issue, isn't it? As long as they can all get their university scholarships and I don't have to pay for any university, that'll be ideal. We'll see.
Yeah, for sure. Just before we finish, we just wanted to touch upon, obviously, you ran 25 sub 4 minute miles in your career. Like, that's quite an achievement. And do you almost think that, how different is the 1500 to the mile? Because we've seen, obviously, Josh Kerr ran the record this week. And he went for it in 3:32. How different is the event? How much does that 100 metres take out, particularly, I guess, indoors as well?
I don't think the actual distance changes anything. I think it's just the we run the mile indoors in the US, and the indoor track changes a lot. It really minimizes your amount of passing opportunities. You have to be a lot more tactically astute to win races. You know, we saw with Josh, I don't think he'll mind me saying, we saw the Josh who made a tactical error at Millrose. Granted, Ollie is incredibly fit and an incredible athlete, but I think Josh should have won that race. And I think he could have had he not made the tactical error. But that's, I mean, you're talking, because you've got two incredible athletes, you're talking one slight slip up and the thing's toast. And that's who wins and that's who loses. But had Josh waited to change gears and pass him for another maybe 100, 150 meters, then he might have got there. But it's hard. It's hard to make those passes on the indoor track and hold positions and stuff like that. I think that's probably the main difference.
Sounds like you're very much still, you know, enjoying watching the sport.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I couldn't have cared less about watching track when I was competing. Like,
really,
most of the events in track and field, I'm like, this is a bit boring. Yeah. Like, even the 10K, I'll watch. I'm like, it's on in the background. You're not even watching it until the last 5 minutes. And I'm like, yeah, this is boring. Like, so, but yeah, it's more so, I'd say I'm more fans of the people than I am necessarily the sport. You know, I've got a lot of emotional energy invested in so many athletes that I've known throughout the years, and you know, I just want to see them succeed. I want to see them do well. And I'd say that's the reason that I'm more watching it. That's the reason I'm watching those races than just like being a huge track fan.
Yeah.
That links into that. I am, but you know, not as much as others.
But that links into like our final point of just, you know, track should do more, you know, or distance runners should do more to celebrate them individuals. Because like you say, you take more of an interest if you feel like, you know, that person a little bit, you know, and you're following someone.
Yeah, I mean, you know, rivalries are important as well. Without, you know, you see it in sports like boxing all the time. There's a good guy and a bad guy, right? And there's villains of the sport, and people make millions of dollars or pounds being the villain. And you know, but I don't think it's really in the nature of track. Of track and field competitors per se, and you know, a lot of those rivalries are created just to sell tickets. They're not they're not kind of organic rivalries. I think, you know, if you take like Josh and Ollie, like they've got great rivalry, but I'm sure they still, they probably warmed up and cooled down together at Millrose. Like it is just the way it is. I mean, you can't just create those rivalries. I think there's a lot of different ways to make track and field more accessible to fans and more, make it a bit more interesting to fans. But just with the nature of having that many events in one track and field, you know, event, or that many disciplines in an event, makes that a bit more difficult. Mm-hmm. And I'm no expert on how to create a better fan experience, but there's definitely room for that to grow, for sure.
Who's going to run quicker then? Is Josh Kerr going to run 3:27 this year, do you think?
I certainly wouldn't be surprised. I certainly would not be surprised at all. And I wouldn't be surprised if Jake did it as well.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I mean, it's going to be interesting for sure. And I think what's really cool is, times aside, what's really cool is that they both, and other athletes as well, have huge opportunities to win several medals over the next 4 or 5 years and really kind of change how the world sees British track and field.
Mm. Well, look, it feels like we said finally a couple of times already, but just actually before,
no worries.
What are you up to now? Like, what's next for you?
So I'm a commercial real estate broker as a profession, so multifamily. So, you know, in layman's terms, we broker the sale of multifamily apartment complexes and the land to build apartment complexes. And so, yeah, I mean, selling them to, you know, everything from kind of 100 unit complexes to 300 unit complexes and the land in between. So, yeah, it's a hugely relationship driven business. So it's good fun. But it's definitely different from being a professional athlete. Don't get to nap as much, certainly.
Well, he looks quite a professional still, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He's all suited up.
Trying my best. I've got my running shorts on under the desk.
Yeah, are you still getting in a bit of mileage here and there? Do you reckon that will ever leave you?
I can't say I've actually ran a step in probably 6 months.
Oh, wow. My God.
I think just like, I was kind of so emotionally drained by like the rehab process post-surgery, and then running after that, it was like, takes me 20-25 minutes to like get my body ready to go and run.
Right.
It's not that interested.
Not
so being boxing is my primary source of fitness, if you will. So that's been fun to kind of get into something a bit different that's got like a technical aspect to it. I'm a big fan of boxing as well for a long time. So it's good fun.
Yeah. Well, all the best of it. It's refreshing to see that someone's not actually just thinking, oh, I have to do something within the sport, like for a career, and then also just, yeah, for your exercise as well. So it's refreshing to see.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure I'll get back into running soon enough for a kind of a social level. It was a long time of slogging through it when I didn't really want to do it. So, you know, waking up and not having that kind of pressure of like, I have to go and run. Like, I still wake up sometimes and I'm like, how far have I got to run? Wait, don't have to run today. Nice.
Yeah.
Don't have to run today. Don't have to run tomorrow. Don't have to run next week. Like, so yeah, it's nice.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming on. You've been a great guest.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me. And I hope that the podcast continues to go from strength to strength.
Step
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.